There's no free lunch when it comes to investing. But what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast with, for a change, Greg and Colin today.
Right.
Yep.
Or is Colin and Greg?
You can say Colin and Greg.
All right.
But I have a hard time saying Colin and Greg because then I feel like I'm talking in third person. Like Colin said, you should listen to this podcast.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
Right?
All right. Okay, good.
Okay, so last week we talked about how stocks find you.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the importance of two things, one of them being market timing.
Yep.
Which we both agreed is very... Well, it's all around us in every decision that people make, right? Mm-hmm. And the second one being diversification.
Yeah.
And so today we're, and I know we've talked about diversification many times on our podcast.
And probably we'll talk about many more times too.
Because it's so obvious the importance to us, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you're faced with like the current market situation where you've got, well, all those things in the news that are going on around you.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Anyways, so why don't we just get into it?
Sure. So as you alluded to, we do tend to drone on and on about diversification. And and because I think, as we discussed, again, it is one of the most important things and one of the biggest mistakes that individuals can make by being under-diversified or undiversified in their portfolios. Mm-hmm. So let's just talk about diversification a little bit. And we'll just, you know, for anyone that hasn't heard this, it'll be new. And for others, it'll be a refresher.
Yeah. But even as a refresher, still listen to it.
Still important, absolutely. Yeah. So the thing about diversification is that it does not directly increase expected stock returns. You know, so people think, oh, okay, well, it's a better portfolio. It should do better. Mm-hmm. And it's not exactly that. So we're not expecting increased stock returns. But what it does do is it improves risk-adjusted returns, meaning that it allows investors to get similar returns to something else, an index or what have you, with lower risk or higher returns for the same level of risk. Mm-hmm. And so really we have to talk about, well, how does it do that? Like how does diversification improve both the quality and the consistency of returns? So the first thing we'll talk about is unsystematic risk. Mm-hmm. Okay, so unsystematic risk can be nearly eliminated by owning a diverse mix of stocks. So what's unsystematic risk? Well, it's the specific risk of owning a particular company, let's say. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's unrelated to the market as a whole, and it's specifically tied to that particular investment.
So from our last episode, we talked about Tesla a lot.
Yes.
So unsystematic risk would be the risk of Tesla stock versus the risk of being invested in the stock market.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so unsystematic risk, you can practically eliminate it by having enough holdings in the portfolio. Mm-hmm. So if you own one company, obviously you've got a lot of unsystematic risk. If you hold 10,000 companies, you have virtually none.
Yeah.
Because no one company would have that big an effect on your portfolio.
I like that term, idiosyncratic risk.
Oh, yeah.
That's a fun term to say.
Yeah, because there's a number of different, there's unsystematic, which we're talking about here. Same as idiosyncratic, meaning, well, it's an idiosyncrasy of the particular company you own.
Yeah.
Or sometimes they'll call it specific risk.
Yeah.
All means the same thing.
Yeah.
It just means it's not the systematic risk of being in the stock markets.
But isn't it just fun to say idiosyncratic?
It is. It's a good word. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Excellent vocabulary. You know, and so again, because the more holdings, the more your risk is limited to the systematic risk of being in the market, it's less dependent on individual companies within the stock market doing well. And so if you get bad earnings or scandals, hey, we're just talking about scandals earlier.
Yeah, don't go to a Coldplay concert if you're having an affair.
No, don't go to a Coldplay. Things like that, sector downturns, other things things that could affect the portfolio are offset if you have a diverse enough portfolio. And so
Right. But the opposite of that is that if you have idiosyncratic risk in your portfolio, so unsystematic risk, like concentrated positions, you could absolutely do better than the market.
Sure you could.
It's a trade-off of risk, right?
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And so, yes, and that's why it's important, you know, to identify that, no, you're not saying that you can do better than any other portfolio. It's just you can do better with taking less risk.
Right.
Okay. So we talked about reducing the unsystematic risk. And you can actually improve the risk-adjusted returns. And this is something called the Sharpe ratio.
Yep.
Okay, and the Sharpe ratio refers to how much return you get per unit of risk you're taking. And so the other side of what we're talking about is by reducing the volatility without reducing expected returns, you get a higher Sharpe ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and therefore,
sounds good.
Therefore, more efficient portfolios deliver better return for each unit of risk that you take.
Yep.
The third benefit is having access to global or sectoral growth. So when you diversify across countries, you're not limited to the fortunes of a single economy or industry. And, you know, if you look back, and I think we talked about this a few episodes or when I was talking about how things have changed over the 30 years since I got into the business. You know, one of the things that used to be the case in Canada is you couldn't have more than, I think, 30% of your RSP portfolio in international or non-Canadian stocks.
Yeah.
And so that forced, you know, Canadian portfolios largely into RSPs. And so great concentration in Canadian stocks. And some years that was great if, you know, energy stocks did well or bank stocks did well. But totally locked us out of the technology and healthcare sectors, which, as we know, have done, you know, extremely well in other parts of the world.
Well, and it led to some product, I don't know, construction.
Yep.
Back in those days, you're right, you could only have a maximum of 30% foreign exposure. So instead, you had these Canadian fund companies that would come out with Canadian domiciled funds on foreign markets. I think they did it through derivatives.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which increases costs and again, doesn't give you that direct exposure that you want.
Yeah. But let's talk a little bit about, so you talked about diversifying across countries.
Yeah.
This is really important because I think 90% of Canadians have 90% of their wealth invested in Canada. Is it probably a pretty accurate statistic?
Yeah. Well, and particularly when you consider that part of their wealth, you know, the largest part of most people's wealth is their home.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at your home, even just looking at financial assets, there's still a big weighting towards Canada.
Right.
Particularly because a lot of the portfolios, and we've talked about this before, are the same Canadian stock portfolios that, you know, your dad would have had.
Yeah.
Maybe even your grandpa, right?
Yeah.
Because of, you know, banks, utilities, pipelines, you know, make up the bulk of the, you know, Canadian stock holdings.
Oh, no, my grandpa didn't have that portfolio.
No.
My grandpa didn't have any money.
Oh, there you go.
So, okay. So yeah. He had Canada savings bonds.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. But I mean, the extreme example, the opposite example of this is when you look at the returns by geographic region, I mean, some of the most recent years have shown like the Philippines has had the best returning market in the world.
Or Denmark.
Like it's different every year, right?
That's right.
But it would be crazy to say, well, let's put 90% of our wealth in Denmark or 90% of our wealth in the Philippines.
Right. Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So absolutely the access to global growth, you know, and sectors that aren't available, you know, in Canada, for example, largely speaking, the technology and healthcare sectors, and, you know, are a dramatic improvement to the portfolios as a whole.
Yep.
One of the things that, you know, with the diversification we've talked about in the past is just the ability to avoid catastrophic losses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you look at concentrated portfolios, you can, you know, some of the massive drawdowns that we've seen, you know, technology stocks in 2000 or, you know, stocks in general in 2008.
Yeah.
You know, or 2020 with COVID. I mean, the diversification, not only among stocks, but between stocks, bonds, and other asset classes, it just helps you avoid that. You know, and we've always talked about how when you buy a single stock, there's two potential outcomes. You know, you can get rich or you can lose everything.
Yeah.
And most investors don't want to lose everything. Everybody wants to get rich, so we can accept that. But most people don't want to lose everything.
I'm going to argue against that a little bit. Because there is this notion that everybody wants to get rich. I don't think everybody wants to get rich.
Right.
I think everybody wants to know that they're going to be okay.
Right.
Right? And, you know, we have some pretty wealthy clients. And sometimes I wonder, how much is enough?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
When you stop worrying about it.
Yeah.
And it's shocking to me when you meet with somebody that has tens and tens of millions of dollars that they're still worried about the stock market.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
It is. It is. And you know, and there's lots of people with, you know, $500,000 that, you know, that are envious of people with 2 million, and the people with 2 million can be envious of people with 8 million and so on. Mm-hmm. So you raise a good point. It's like, what do you need?
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things that we've always talked about with, you know, establishing financial plans is, mm-hmm. is, you know, what do you need? And I'd still argue that lots of people would enjoy the thought of getting rich.
Yeah, sure.
But you're right. It's what do you need, et cetera.
Well, and I think so, we had Sarah Newcomb on our show a couple of years ago from Morningstar.
Yep.
And she said something like, I've been poor and I've had money and it's much better having money.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah,
I can't remember the exact
quote. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So again, the diversification helps reduce that chance of a permanent loss of capital.
Sure.
And again, and then, and as I talked earlier, when we talked about diversification among asset classes, what that does is it leverages low or negative correlations. And so correlations just refer to how much different types of investments move in the same direction or at the same rate.
Yeah.
And by combining assets that move differently, so stocks and bonds or growth stocks or value stocks, large companies or small companies, it reduces the overall volatility or you know, risk in the portfolio, mm-hmm. and can increase, you know, expected returns because of gains you get from rebalancing the portfolio.
Yeah.
So if you think of rebalancing, what you're really doing is just getting your portfolio back to whatever your strategic mix is. Let's say, for argument's sake, let's say 50% stocks, 50% bonds. Mm-hmm. Well, if stocks suffer a downturn like we did during, you know, 2008, the global financial crisis, then rebalancing is going to force you to sell some bonds, which did relatively better, and buy some stocks, which did mm-hmm. relatively poorer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're buying those stocks at low prices, and so that can increase your returns.
Yeah.
Just by the simple act of rebalancing, you don't need to overthink it.
I have a little bit of a problem with part of this, is that I'm very argumentative today.
Go for it. I mean, nobody says we have to be in perfect agreement.
Well, no, we are in agreement. But during the most recent bear market that we experienced, not that long ago, and people said, well, you know, I own bonds and I own stocks. I own bonds because they're supposed to protect my portfolio, but they also went down at the same time as stocks went down. So they didn't do what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Which is not true. They did what they're supposed to do. They just didn't, because they didn't go down as much as stocks.
Exactly.
Right? Because bonds are not inversely correlated to stocks.
That's right.
They just have a lower correlation.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that maybe people, you know, in your ideal world, you know, your asset classes would be negatively correlated. Mm-hmm. So if one goes down, you know the other one will go up.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't always happen. Mm-hmm. And we saw that for a while in 2022, and we saw that for a while in 2008, where stocks and bonds went down together at the same time.
Yeah.
But as you say, and even in 2022, which was one of the worst years for bonds probably in 40 years, I think it was the worst year in 40 years, they didn't go down as much.
Yeah.
So by having bonds in the portfolio, if you had only stocks, you'd have been down 20%. And if you had bonds, you were down 12 or 13%.
Yeah.
So that protected downside.
So even in your rebalancing strategy, so if you had 50% of your investments were down 12%,
yep.
and 50% were down 20%,
mm-hmm.
then your bonds would have outperformed,
yep.
which means you would have sold some bonds.
Yep.
And you would have, and bought some stocks that were lower,
yep.
and you would have had a better return.
Exactly.
After. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So really.
See, we agree.
Well, we do.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm in violent agreement on that. Anyway, so there's a lot of empirical evidence that show diversified portfolios outperform concentrated ones on a risk-adjusted basis.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a well-diversified, even an S&P 500 index fund, which some people might argue is not even totally diversified because it's largely large companies,
yeah.
will outperform most actively managed portfolios over long periods, not by having the highest returns, but by having more consistent returns with less downside. And so I think that kind of leads into my next topic, which is passive funds versus active funds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because most actively managed funds are by definition, Well, maybe not by definition. Most actively managed funds are more concentrated than the market itself.
Or more active.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so if you think about it, even just a U.S. stock fund, I mean, there's 3,500 stocks that you could buy that trade on the U.S. exchange. Mm-hmm. And most actively managed portfolios don't hold 3,500 stocks for a number of reasons. One is that it could be costly to, you know, for transactions to own that many stocks. Rebalancing could be costly. And most fund managers want to focus on, you know, the 50 to 100 stocks that they believe will outperform the market as a whole, because they're trying to outperform.
Well, they're trying to show value, right?
That's right.
So they you end up with a lot of fund managers that become closet indexers and then overweight a few companies to show that they're active.
That's right. Yeah. You know. Now, the interesting thing is that the data is actually pretty clear. And the data basically shows that passive funds have notably outperformed actively managed fund over the last decade. Mm-hmm. In terms of both consistency and net returns. And that's happened, you know, in virtually every time period, as long as the time period is long enough. So we're talking about this now in 2025. But back in 2010, we would have seen that the same thing. And and so this data can be tracked and is tracked, you know, on a pretty regular basis by companies like Morningstar. And so if you look at it over the last 10 years through 2024, 80 to 95% of active funds globally failed to beat their benchmark over that 10-year period.
But 100% of those 80 to 95% funds also charged higher fees than the market.
That's right, absolutely. And over the same time period, only about, well, the balance, you know, up to 5 to 20% of actively managed funds, you know, beat their passive benchmark. Mm-hmm. And as you say, there's good reason for that, and fees are absolutely one of the biggest reasons, because actively managed funds incur fees. They have to employ lots of analysts, you know, research analysts who are going to analyze the heck out of stocks, and they have lots of transactions, so there's a lot of turnover in those portfolios, typically up to 50%, so they have to execute a lot of transactions.
Well, they have employees, they have benefits, they have whatever, healthcare.
And many firms actually, you know, charge their marketing costs to their management expense ratio, meaning that investors in their funds are paying for the fund companies to market their funds, you know, externally to new investors. So again, it's definitely a tough challenge for actively managed funds to outperform the benchmarks. And there is what's interesting is there's some regional differences. Like, so in North America, you know, according to MarketWatch, just about 22% of active funds outperformed over 10 years. Global funds was a little bit better, about 30% had success in beating their passive benchmarks. And mainly emerging markets like Asia, excluding Japan and the UK, active funds had higher but still kind of modest outperformance rates, maybe 40 to 64%. So at best, even if you're talking about some of the best periods of time or best sectors or regions for actively managed fund, it's still a 50-50 chance, you know, sort of.
So don't do it.
Well, don't do it.
I think that's the punchline.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe let's just, again, we talked a little bit about lower costs and fees as being one of the main drivers of outperformance of passive over active funds. You know, if you look at passive funds, their expense ratios can be as low as 6 basis points, which in regular language means 0.06%.
Yeah.
Whereas active funds could be anywhere from 0.5 or 0.5% to 1.1% or more.
Well, I've seen some recently that were in the kind of 2 to 3% range.
Exactly.
So you're paying 3% to underperform the market.
Yeah.
So so that fund manager has to beat the market by 3% every year.
Every year.
To get market returns.
So what's 3% compounded annually or, you know, for 10 years? I don't know, but it's a big number. It's over 30%, obviously.
Over 30, yeah.
So very difficult to chew your way through those and still beat the market through superior stock picking. And even if you look at, if you look at passive funds, the net returns, again, are higher. So you could actually get, you know, active funds that have similar or even better gross, you know, this is what we've been talking about, you know, gross performance before you include the effect of fees, but not on a net basis. And so even the cheapest funds still have a hard time because they're still adding 0.5% a year or something like that to the overall cost.
Right.
And in fact, I think it was a Morningstar research study that showed that the best predictor of future fund performance, actively managed fund performance, was the fee.
Yeah.
The lower the fee, the better the, you know, the better the expected return.
Yeah. And so fees are really really important.
Yep.
Because they do take away from the net return to investors, yep, right?
Exactly.
So we're always focused on, you know, obviously, listen, we're not in a charitable organization. We have fees in our industry and in our business. But we're really focused on reducing the fees as much as possible with the full understanding that the less people pay, the more they keep.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, for sure. So another issue that sometimes causes active managed funds to lag passive is sometimes they might own fewer of the market leaders. You know, so if you're an active fund manager, you know, many might be tempted to, let's take the current market environment. So we've got the Mag 7 stocks that everyone talks about, the Magnificent 7, you know, and those include NVIDIA, Microsoft, Apple, Alphabet, you know,
Meta,
Tesla in some cases, you know, and so some active managers might overweight those, which may help in certain periods of time, and it may hurt, you know, if they, you know, because those stocks can be pretty volatile.
Well, I think from a thematic basis, if you look back at during COVID, the explosion of semiconductors, right? So if you were an active fund manager, you might be right in your thesis that we should be investing in semiconductors, but you might pick the wrong company.
That's right.
Right? So, because NVIDIA before COVID was not what NVIDIA is today.
No. Right? And it wasn't on a lot of people's radar, you know, and what brought it onto people's radar was its incredible performance starting a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's quite possible that actively managed funds might actually underweight or avoid some of those market leaders because their belief that it's short-lived, valuations are too high.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of reasons why certain fund managers would avoid those stocks, and therefore you could risk, you know, some significant underperformance just by actively avoiding the wrong, you know, what turned out to be the right sectors for some period of time.
Right. It's no different than, I know we've looked at those statistics in the past about if you miss the best 1 day period, 1 week period, 1 month period, and you're just not invested. It's kind of the same.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And so the last thing is just the consistency and diversification, you know, of passive funds, which tend to maintain broad market exposure consistently, which just reduces the risk of manager errors or missteps in trying to trade in and out of certain sectors or certain regions that didn't work out, you know, as the manager expected.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes just being, you know, being everywhere all at once, so to speak, can just reduce those errors and avoid the underperformance.
Yeah. I think what I hear you saying, Greg, is that stock picking doesn't really work. Market timing doesn't really work, but you can be diversified and just stay invested and make it through all kinds of cycles. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Now, let's, you know, why don't we finish off? Oh, first of all, let me give one tip of the hat to some sectors, some areas where active management might actually help.
Okay.
Okay, and so there are some areas. Here's three areas where active management may have actually helped. UK small and mid-cap equity.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody is interested specifically in investing solely in United Kingdom small and mid-cap stocks, there's a chance 50%, maybe up to 70%, that you might outperform. Global emerging markets, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is bonds and real estate.
Yeah.
So what we found is that 53% of bond funds and 55% of real estate funds outperformed passive investing back in 2023, according to Barron's. Still kind of rare, and it's still, you know, 53 and 55 is pretty close to 50-50.
Yeah.
But at least, like, there may be a chance.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this a lot with regards to bond investing.
Well, bond investing is so misunderstood.
Exactly.
Right? Like, the stock market is a centralized auction market.
Yep.
The bond market is not.
That's right.
It's just a different structure. So that makes sense to me.
Yep, exactly. And I think that the thing with the other thing with bonds is that when you look at, for instance, pick a sector of the bond market, high yield bonds, or high yield bonds are the riskiest bonds, mm-hmm. right? They're the bonds from companies that have a lower credit rating, maybe, you know, AAA bonds are the highest rated, typically governments, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you get down into double B, single B bonds, these are the highest risk bonds. Mm-hmm. And so there's they pay higher yields, but there's a greater risk that they'll default. Well, if you buy a high yield bond ETF, which is just based on the market, mm-hmm. then what you're getting is a portfolio of bonds issued by the highest, the riskiest companies, mm-hmm. and by the companies that issue the highest number of bonds.
Yeah.
And so if more outstanding bonds, if companies with higher credit risk, you know, issue a lot of bonds, then you're going to get way more of that particular company's bonds in your portfolio. Mm-hmm. That could be risky. Mm-hmm. Whereas bond managers can go through and identify, you know, based on the terms of the bonds, which bonds are the best ones to own, which ones have the most security attached to them, and so on. So, mm-hmm. so you can understand, it's not a guarantee that passive or that active bond management is going to outperform, mm-hmm. but you can understand why it might. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's a lot harder in equity investing. Yeah. So the last thing I wanted to just touch on for 1 minute is that, you know, so a lot of people say, well, passive. And when we talk about passive investing, we're not necessarily talking only about indexes. Like, there's a number of fund companies that we know well and have used over years that have very, very diverse portfolios, and they use mm-hmm. quantitative methods to decide what stocks should be in the portfolio and what stocks shouldn't be. And people will say, oh, yeah, but, you know, God, there's 13,000 stocks. Mm-hmm. This one particular company, can I mention their name?
Of course.
Dimensional Fund Advisors has a world equity fund. It has over 13,500 stocks in it.
Can't get more diversified than that.
Can't get more diversified. But does that mean they're missing out on everything that's happening in the U.S. market with the Mag 7 that we just talked about? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. The top holdings in that fund are still NVIDIA, Microsoft, Apple, mm-hmm. Meta, you know, Alphabet or Google, Amazon. So you still have exposure to them, mm-hmm. but instead of them representing, you know, let's say 35% to 40% of the U.S. market, in the dimensional fund, they might represent 20% or 22% of the fund. And so mm-hmm. you're not missing out by any means. It's still the largest part of your portfolio.
You're just spreading your risk.
But you've got the other 80% is invested in another 13,000 stocks.
Yeah.
And so you can be extremely well diversified, but not give up the exposure to the parts of the market that are doing well at any point.
Yeah. So, you know what? I'm going to take a minute as well.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Please do.
I had a very troubling conversation with somebody the other day who came in the office, wanted to learn about our firm.
Yep.
This is a person that is one of the leaders of another firm in Calgary.
Yep.
I won't mention their names because I don't want to.
Yeah.
But we were just talking about investing strategies, things like that.
Right.
Now, their claim to fame was that they do a individual stock portfolio to which they personally pick the stocks and manage, and it's heavily weighted to Canada.
Right.
So that was like red flag number one, right? Red flag number two was we started talking about fixed income. And they said, well, they primarily invest in things like convertible debentures, high yield products for their fixed income exposure. Mm-hmm. This is red flag number two for anybody listening, because convertible debentures and specifically high yield fixed income tends to operate with same risk characteristics as equity positions.
That's right.
Right?
Exactly.
So when I heard this person telling me their thesis, I just thought, oh my gosh, I'm glad I'm not with you.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more risk in that portfolio than the clients that they're managing the money for might not understand.
That's right. Right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Have we beaten that dead horse?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That'll be it for today. Next week, we'll find something else to beat.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, and exempt market dealer. Canvas Wealth is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy cannot be guaranteed and is subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals and do not represent the opinion of Q Wealth as a firm.